Well, if you're a pet owner, you want to keep your pet safe, healthy, and as warm weather approaches, there are some extra concerns you want to be aware of and probably address. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and I'm really happy to have our guest today, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, back once again. She comes by once a month to spend some time with you and with me, and she has always has some great advice. And Dr. Sandy, great to have you back.
It is so nice to be back, but if you hear me yawning, it's because if you haven't been to the Facebook page, there's a picture of Pete there, my new puppy, my first one in 34 years.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, you know, I've always adopted dogs that needed homes, and I just decided that it's a good time in my life, and now I'm questioning my sanity because my partner Mark is out of town, and doing all the puppy care, keeping him safe. I have two ponds in my backyard. We've had to fence them off. So we've got, you know, it's not very pretty right now. But, you know, he's always getting into stuff. And it's, you know, even the middle of the night potty breaks and so on. So I'm a little haggard right now.
Busy gal. Really a cutie, though.
Oh, yeah. He's a lot of fun. His name's Pete. I wanted to call him Repeat because I've had a number of bulldogs. But I think you'd have to have a Pete. The next one I'll get, we'll call Repeat. So,
well, there you go. So go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show to see a photo of Pete. Also, if you have some photos of your pets and you want to post them, we always love to see them. And so do that as well at the Larry Mueller Show. And, of course, questions, call us at 1-800-642-1234. You know, as this weather warms up, you know, there are a lot of things to kind of watch out for. Overheating.
Oh, definitely. And with me being a bulldog owner, obviously that's something I have to be really careful of, is making sure that we have air conditioning, that we're not leaving them in hot vehicles, that I am watching them and sometimes being their brains. And it doesn't matter what breed of dog you've got. If they are a go, go, go all the time, you need to make sure that they're taking breaks, that they're getting plenty of water, because heat stroke is a serious problem for dogs. And, you know, and most people associate it with things like just being stuck in a hot vehicle, but you can have it happen in your own backyard if you've got a dog that's just overexerting itself and doesn't have a place to get out of the sun.
Does the dog, what typically happens? Does it pass out?
They are usually panting like crazy, huge wide mouth pants. The gums may turn kind of a muddy color rather than being pink. They'll either go like a real dark red or kind of a, you know, purpley red. They may start getting some diarrhea. They're going to be mentally not all there. They're going to feel hot to the touch. And, you know, the best thing you can do is get some cold towels over them, soak their feet, and get them into an emergency clinic right away. And that's something that's so important. You know, we always have on our refrigerators, you know, how to get a hold of, you know, 911 and people for us. But you should have and know of a way to reach an emergency clinic to be able to get your pet in, especially if you're traveling. You're out of town. I've been going up to Road America with my pets up in Elkhart Lake and having lots of fun up there. But boy, that's one of the things that, you know, it's like, even though I'm a veterinarian, I still may need some help. And so I keep a list of kind of local practices that I can depend on if I need to when I'm up there.
And what would they do if your dog is...
They would get them on IV fluids, and start, because these dogs are shocky, and start to cool them down. They may be giving them cool water enemas, but you have to be really careful. If you cool them down too fast, their body temperature is going to drop, and it's going to be just the opposite. They become hypothermic, and it's harder to get their body temperature back up. So it's really tricky to monitor these dogs and treat them.
Been outside a lot, and I have not. I've been using sunscreen, and I have not really burned at all. I've been good this year for a change. But what about our pets? Do our dogs get sunburns?
They definitely can. And it, you know, really depends on the breed of the dog, how much hair they have. Certain breeds, obviously, like some of the hairless dogs or the sparsely haired dogs are going to be more at risk. They do make pet safe sunblocks and things that you can use. And, you know, again, just keeping them, know your dog and keep them out of the sun if they're sensitive. We can see different things like different skin cancers and so on. particularly, you know, in white-haired pets, ear tips, noses, and so on. And just it's just like us. Those are the spots that are going to be thin-skinned and easily burned.
And we're, I should mention, we're going to be talking with the author of The Dog Lover's Guide to Travel on Thursday, June 17th.
Oh, wonderful. Well, maybe I should just put aside my tips because they probably have some really good ones. But like I'm speaking from the veterinarian standpoint of what you should take with you. And yeah, but that's, I'd have to make sure I listen to that.
Yeah, that's, it's an interesting book for sure. We have... lots of things we can talk about. We have so many calls, so let's just go to the phones for a few minutes here and see what's on Jean's mind for Mercer to begin. Hi, Jean.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. We have a 10-and-a-half-year-old female black lab who is typically very active and outside a lot. But this year, the mosquitoes in northern Wisconsin have been so bad that we're not letting her out except for short walks. She is on heart guard, and she's had frontline applied. I'm wondering, is there any mosquito repellent we could use for her? And then the other thing is that I just thought of is she's on fish oil, 1,000 milligrams a day. Could that make her any more attractive to mosquitoes?
Probably not. I've never heard of that being an issue before, but good that you're using flea and tick preventative, but there are some flea and tick preventatives out there that do have on the label mosquito repellency. One of them that comes to mind is by the Bayer company called Advantix. It has a, one of the active ingredients is a permethrin, and that is the active ingredient that helps repel mosquitoes. I was reading about how, you know, for people, for ticks and mosquitoes, about using permethrin soaked clothing and things to be able to, you know, keep them off of us. I don't recommend that for your dog because you may not get the dosage right. And they obviously are not going to be showering like we are, and it may end up getting on their hair coat. But and there are other things that you may want to look into. If the mosquitoes are really bad around her head, they do make some kind of almost like the same type of insect guards that they make for horses. They make those for dogs as well. It's like a mesh that some dogs tolerate really well and others don't, but that might be something to look into. There are some gels and creams that have pyrethrin in it, which is the natural version of permethrin. Unfortunately, they don't last very long, and you do need to apply them kind of like us with some of the mosquito things that we use. Obviously, don't put DEET on your dog. That can be, again, dosages and toxicity issues could be a real problem. So none of the human products would be safe for use on your dog. But these other ones that contain permethrin or pyrethrin, that you can apply them to ear tips, nose, and so on. And again, just, you know, doing it a couple times a day to make the dog feel more comfortable.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right.
Great. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Jean. Matt in Fitchburg. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. I've got an almost two-year-old Australian cattle dog / border collie, and I'm really concerned about, you know, hot days with him. I don't have indoor air conditioning. And so I take him out, let him swim around in the lakes, the local lakes, almost daily in the summer. I'm wondering, is there anything I need to do regarding his skin and coats to balance that out?
Well, if he's on a healthy diet and is genetically, a good model for the breed and has good skin barrier, doesn't have any issues like with allergies or anything like that, getting him wet should not be an issue, but you obviously need to pay close attention to certain areas like ears, because if they get a lot of water in there, it can macerate the ear and predispose them to infections. And so talking to your veterinarian about using an ear cleaner drying agent, typically we don't like to use them more than about once a week, but you know, if they're in the water a lot, it may be something that you're going to have to use a little more frequently. One thing that comes to mind, and again, it's not even involving the hair coat, is the infectious disease called leptospirosis. It's a bacteria that is in water. It likes to live in water. It's a little spirochete that's spread through the urine of infected animals, which can include a whole host of wildlife species like raccoons, rats, deer, you know, cattle, which aren't wildlife. But and that is in our water. And if your dog isn't current on that vaccine, I would definitely recommend that before you start your summer swimming schedule, you get that vaccinated and get that kept up to date and be current. But probably the big thing is, you know, getting into some of these lakes that have a lot of algae. You have to be really watchful for algae blooms. Again, you know, blue-green algae ingestion can be fatal for dogs. And so if you, you know, the water at all looks murky, algae-filled, avoid those areas. If he does happen to jump into a spot like that, boy, they can stink pretty bad as that vegetation that's floating in the water starts fermenting in your dog's hair coat. So even hosing them down, you don't even have to literally shampoo them, but just hosing them down is going to make them a little bit better pet to have at your home after being in the lakes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. You can join in as well, by the way, as we talk with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post a question and photo, if you'd like, of your pet at the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And to go there, just type in the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and you'll get right there. And Katie in Hartford, you are next. Hi, Katie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling because I have a one-year-old Springer Spaniel, and about a month ago she was diagnosed with canine vestibular syndrome because she was falling over and her eyes were moving back and forth. We thought she was having a seizure or something. And we took her in, and the doctor gave us several different medications. She thought maybe it was an inner ear infection that was causing this.
Mm-hmm.
But she did say that there's really no way to be sure of what it was unless we take her to a neurologist,
mm-hmm.
and which would obviously be very expensive. She has gotten better. She just seems to have this head tilt, and her tongue hangs to the left side of her mouth all the time.
Okay.
And my question is, last week our next-door neighbor's dog was diagnosed with the same thing, although their dog is quite a bit older, and I know it's more common in older dogs.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering if it was anything maybe environmental that could have caused it?
It's very unlikely to be something in the environment. You started saying the neighbor's dog with the same thing, I was like, huh, that is really odd to have that happen, you know, together. But vestibular disease in dogs is a relatively common problem, and we can see a number of different presentations with it. And first of all, I have to give you just a little neuroanatomy lesson so that, and that always scares a lot of people, but the vestibular or the balance system is made up of kind of two main parts. The central part, which is in the brain, that is kind of the workhorse of the balance system, and then it's also in the middle ear area as well. And so we've got the peripheral nerves out in that area that help with your balance and so on. And so it can be, any of those areas can be affected. The condition that we see that we sometimes called old dog vestibular disease, or it's also called idiopathic, which just means we don't know the cause, vestibular disease, typically affects older dogs. It comes on very quickly. Many people think, oh, they're having a stroke or something because all of a sudden they're either, you know, their head's tilted, they can't walk, they're falling down all the time. These dogs usually get better with just supportive care within a matter of a few days, and they have very little residual head tilt or any problems left over. It's just, you know, if you go looking for a problem or for a reason, you're not going to find anything. The fact that your dog is young makes me kind of go, that's probably not what's going on. It's probably not this idiopathic issue. But, you know, we start thinking, you know, could it be something else? And with the tongue hanging out, a month of a persistent head tilt, I'm really worried that you may have something different going on. And if it is something like a middle ear infection, sometimes, you know, just treating them medically is not going to be effective. You may be looking at surgical intervention to be able to treat the middle ear cavity and get that under control. So I think, you know, the visit to a veterinary neurologist or someone with an interest in neurology is a really good idea. They'll put your dog through a thorough neurologic exam to try to localize, is this in the brain or is this out in the periphery? And then that's going to tell us where we need to go. Do we need to do an MRI? Do we need to do a CT scan? Do we need to be collecting spinal fluid so that we can help with getting an answer for your dog? And yeah, a month, it's time to get this looked into. This is not the idiopathic syndrome.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for calling. We got a nice email from Sue in Westby who wonders if you can use human sunblock for a white-haired pit bull. What are the best places to apply it?
Yeah, you know, the problem is dogs are going to lick a lot of the sunblocks and things off. And I have to think that the products that are used in like babies and young children are probably fine. But I really get concerned about, you know, the zinc-based products and so on. If the dog is licking them, they potentially could become toxic. So some of the, you know, real easy ones that you may be able to use for infants may be helpful. But I would recommend a pet-safe sunblock. They do sell them at pet stores. You can get them online. You may even get them through your veterinarian if they happen to carry them. And the probably the best places are the thin-skinned areas over the bridge of the nose, the ear tips, obviously not in the eye, but maybe around the eye and the temples. Those are going to be areas that, just like us, you know, our ear tips, foreheads, and so on, and our nose are always the first thing to get burned. So those are the spots to treat your dog.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here taking a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Questions, give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email your question at talk@WPR.org, or you can go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, post your question there, and you can post your photos of your pets. And Kim has sent us a...
She has. Hi, Kim, if you're listening. Oh, that's one of her many goldens that she has. And they have such a wonderful life. She lives on a lake and they go swimming all the time.
Oh.
And just are physically fit, active dogs, because mom's active too. And it's the dog, if you can see the picture, is actually got its foot up waving high. So...
It's a wonderful picture. Take a look at it on my Facebook page. Debbie in New Berlin has a question for you. Hi, Deb.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I have a couple of questions. I own a Great Pyrenees. He's a big, very hairy dog. And I've got different opinions from both vets and breeders of the breed about shaving them in the summertime. And I don't mean like bald, but... Mm-hmm. You know, shaving the hair down so they're not so hot in the summer. Some of the breeders say that the hair actually insulates them. And, you know, some of the vets say, oh, that's not true. So I'm just wondering what your opinion is on that.
Well, I think if they're groomed correctly, and that means really getting that undercoat out and so you don't have any matting, leaving as much hair as you can may be helpful. What I worry about more than them getting hot is the fact that if you do shave them, they're going to be predisposed to sunburn because they've lost that protective cover over their pale skin. So that would be something that I'd be really concerned about. So, yeah. But it's going to take a while for the hair coat to grow back. So obviously people that breed and show are going to be recommending don't, you know, mess with the coat,
right?
Because you're not going to be able to get them back in the show ring. So it really is lifestyle dependent for the pet. And I know a lot of dogs are much more comfortable getting some of that real dense hair off of them. And if your dog is, you know, getting wet or, you know, getting into areas like burdocks and so on, it's going to be much easier to get them out if you've got less hair to deal with. They're not going to look the same, but, you know, hey, if looks aren't important, I said go ahead and shave, but be careful with the sun.
Okay. And then the other quick question I had was similar to the other gentleman you talked to about the dog swimming in the lake. We have a cabin up north, and there's nothing I can do. When he gets in that water, he just loves to drink it while he's swimming. And I mean, dangerous. It's kind of quality of life thing. You know, I can't prevent him from going in the water, but he hasn't ever gotten sick yet. But
yeah, I mean, things that we'd get concerned about, like I mentioned, leptospirosis, that bacterial infection. We also get concerned about Giardia. And so many dogs carry Giardia, have Giardia, never show symptoms. But if your dog does break with gastrointestinal signs, that would be something to bring up with your veterinarian and have them look for it on a stool check. We've also seen dogs that are compulsive drinkers when they're in the water develop a condition called bloat, where their stomach enlarges with water and then twists, and it can be life-threatening. So many people think that it's just eating that will do that, but it can be water as well. So sometimes, again, you have to be your dog's brain. And if you start noticing that they're drinking so much that they're starting to, you know, get their abdomens getting bigger, time to get them out of the water, let them rest, and let some of that water get through their system.
Okay. Sounds good. Right. Thanks so much.
Yeah. Thanks, Deb. Carol in Oak Creek. Hi to you.
Hi. Thank you. I put Vetra on my corgi dog before I went on vacation, and he went off to a farm for 10 days, and he got a bath after the 10 days. And I was wondering, does the bath wash off the Vetra?
It's pretty water repellent. I don't get too concerned about bathing, taking it off. It's also going to depend on the type of shampoo you use. If you use a real like stripping benzoyl peroxide type shampoo, that could be a problem. But
I don't know what they used.
Yeah. And that would be something to find out. But,
okay.
It would be safe enough if you felt that, boy, it's like 3 weeks into, you know, since you had applied it, to maybe put it on a week early if you needed to. But that is always something to be concerned about. I don't use a lot of Vectra. Vectra is an excellent product.
What is it for again?
It's a flea and tick product that is the unique thing about it is it has an extra long kind of tube on the end. So if you've got a really heavy coated dog, you can get it down on the skin where you need to have it. It's very similar in activity to Advantix, the Bear company makes. I think, you know, it's a little bit higher volume, but some people feel that they like it because they can get it, apply it to the skin a little bit easier. And I would check the packaging and just see what they say, because usually there should be some wording on there that would tell you, you know, if it's, you know, safe to, you know, bathe the dog and what you can use for bathing.
My vet gave me the Vectrix. Do you recommend something on another product?
No, Vectra is an excellent product. One of the reasons that veterinarians are using it, besides the fact that it's got the cool applicator, is that it is only available through veterinarians. And so it does encourage that communication with the owner. You're going to be getting the right size of medication for your pet. And that, again, if that's the drug that your veterinarian is comfortable with, I'd be giving them a call, because they may have more product info to be able to know just how waterproof it is. But typically, most of the flea and tick products are not going to come off with just simple shampooing.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Tony in Fond du Lac, you're next. Hi, Tony.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
A related question. We have a 22-pound cocker, and we go away to Florida every winter, and about 2 minutes after we're there, our dog has fleas.
Mm-hmm.
And we would just like to, and then we come back to Wisconsin, we just like to have a plan that we can use every year, whether it's, you know, a flea collar, whether it's, you know, putting on that month applicator, every month applicator, something we can just count on doing, you know, every year, because it happens every year.
Oh, and the fleas down there are horrible. What are you using right now?
It's that typical applicator between the shoulder blades once a month.
And then
we've used Capstar a few times when she's really got them bad, just to get rid of them.
Okay.
You know? But we've got a flea collar on her because my sister recommended that.
Do you know which kind of flea collar? Is it the Seresto collar?
It's a little cheap one. It's red.
Okay, no, okay.
One she was recommending one, it was about $49.
Yeah, that's the Seresto collar, and they last for about 8 months, and they are very effective. One of the things, what I've recommended to some of my clients that do spend a lot of time down in the southern states in the winter, is there's an oral flea pill that's called Comfortus, and you can buy it online. You can get it through your veterinarian. We don't carry it at the vet school, and the main reason is that we have, although we do see flea cases, we're definitely more in a tick area, and so we need flea and tick control, and Comfortus just does flea control. But it works extremely well. It's very similar to the product that you mentioned that is the oral pill that you give called Capstar, which is only in their system for a very brief period of time. You have to repeat it daily, but it kills fleas rapidly. This does the same thing, but it lasts for 30 days. And I've had some people either just use that with a spot-on product or a collar, and they've been really happy with kind of doubling up that way. The other thing that you may be able to get the Comfortus, that active ingredient in, is there's a heartworm preventative called Trifexis. It's a little pricey compared to some of the other heartworm preventatives on the market, but it would combine your intestinal parasite, your heartworm, and your flea control in that monthly pill. And you may want to consider using that before you start heading down to Florida, as along with whatever topical product you want to use, because it would be very safe to double up on a topical as well as using the Comfortus.
And that was Trifexis?
Trifexis is the heartworm / Comfortus combination.
And that's given every month?
That's given once a month. So it would be, you have to have your dog on heartworm preventative in Florida anyways, and so this would be something that you would just replace whatever you're using for heartworm preventative up here, if you want to, with that, and using that down there in the winter. The problem is it does not get ticks. So you still have to back them up with some type of tick control. And they have ticks in Florida, just like we have here, a different species in some cases. So you do want to make sure that you're using something that's a flea and tick spot on product or collar as well. And I think the cheap collar, get rid of it. They don't work, okay? If you're going to be spending any money on something, go ahead and get that collar called the Seresto collar. That has probably been, at least in my, what I've seen this year, one of the most effective things around.
Could you spell that for me, please?
Seresto, S-E-R, S as in Sam, E-R, E-S-T-O.
Thank you so much.
Hey, you're welcome.
Great call. Thank you so much, Tony, for calling. And Nancy, thank you for calling. Hi, from La Crosse.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking our call. I had a question related to an eye disease that our 9-year-old standard poodle was diagnosed with in January. Sudden loss of her vision related to, they said, a rod and cone dysfunction.
Mm-hmm.
I had questions, number one, if there's anything new coming out related to this disease that we could help her with.
Oh, I wish there was. What you're describing is a condition that is called SARDS, and it stands for sudden acquired retinal degeneration. And you may have a day or two of these dogs having just kind of partial vision loss, and then they go acutely blind. And it is so sad, and there's no treatment for it, and they don't get better. There has been some thoughts. Some of these dogs will start drinking more and urinating more. And so one of the thoughts is it related to something like Cushing's disease or some type of pituitary problem, but to my knowledge, we still have no idea what causes it, when to expect it. The last case I had with this was the nicest Malamute in the whole. I mean, it was just the sweetest, biggest, hairiest love bug of a dog for 8 or 9 years, and then all of a sudden he became aggressive, and it was because he went acutely blind, and he was just terrified. And it was real. He was a really difficult case to work with. But I think, you know, doing all your homework on how to live with a blind dog, they can live a very enriched, wonderful life even without their vision. There's lots of blind dogs out there that, you know, as long as you've got a fenced yard, you don't move things around a lot, you teach your dog some voice commands and so on. Many dogs do extremely well being blind.
We're trying to make her day as rich as possible. One question I had related to socialization for her. I was wondering if in the dog community, would it be the right thing to do to try to introduce her to other dogs, or would that be too much for her?
It really depends on her. I've seen dogs that are blind at the dog park that they have the other dog just wear a big cowbell, and the blind dog follows the other dog around and does just great. But if she was dog friendly before, doesn't startle real easily, you've got dog-friendly dogs that are going to be respectful of her and realize that she's not going to be able to look at their body signals and so on, and you've got, you know, good owner participation, I think it would be worthwhile to see if she can get back in touch with some of her dog friends.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Good luck.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Really cute photo from Stephanie up on my Facebook page. She apparently sends her Poochie off to the dog den, I guess.
Yeah, doggy daycare. Yes.
Doggy daycare. Yep. The school note for her was, Bear was such a flirt today. He had his eye on three girls in particular.
Uh-oh.
Goose, Hera, and Willow.
Oh,
what a charmer.
I know. And it looks like he's either a Great Dane mix or a Dobie Lab mix, but with those big ears. Oh, my goodness. And he looks like he's pretty tall from the vantage point that camera took that picture.
Stephanie says he enjoys invading my personal space, chasing our Sphinx cat, and flirting with the ladies.
There we go.
Oh, that's a great one. Thank you so much, Stephanie, for sending that. Oh, Jay in Pewaukee, let's turn to you next. Hi, thank you for calling. Yeah.
Hi, Larry. Hi, doctor. Thanks for taking my call.
No problem.
I have a question about a cat that my wife and I adopted. About 6 months after we got him, he was like hacking, and we thought it was a hairball at first, but then, you know, after a few weeks we took him in and they did x-rays, and his chest was very inflamed and everything, so he was diagnosed with bronchitis, and right now he's on prednisolone, 5 mm-hmm. milligrams, half a tablet twice a day, and also half of a theophylline in the evening. And we've tried to reduce the prednisolone because I know steroids aren't good long term. But when we do, then he starts to cough again and, you know, not wheeze, but mm-hmm. I have asthma myself. So when I listen to him, I can hear like the rumbling
mm-hmm.
in his chest and everything. So I'm just wondering, well, and I guess right now, too, we're trying monocycline. 100 milligram.
Okay.
Just to make sure it's not some kind of infection.
Good. I'm writing notes as you're talking here. Thank you for bringing this up. This is one of my little pet peeves as a veterinarian is when cats have hairballs, they vomit them up. They don't cough them up. They're in the stomach. And so almost every cat that people say, oh, they've got chronic hairball issues. I'm like, are they vomiting hair? No, they're just kind of got this coughy, wheezy type thing. And it's like, well, that's absolutely has nothing to do with the intestinal tract. They need to be looked at. And dollar to donuts, most of these cats that come in where the owners think have chronic hairball problems have something else going on. If it is a GI problem, gastrointestinal problem, the hair might just be going along for the ride and they're vomiting for a totally different reason, like they have inflammatory bowel disease or intestinal parasites or something else, you know, allergic food allergies or something else going on. If they're coughing, I'm so glad that your veterinarian went and got chest x-rays, and it probably your cat's been diagnosed, I assume, rather than with bronchitis, with asthma. Asthma is very common in cats, and we do see it. They sometimes, you can treat them orally with prednisone, but often these cats do better with an inhaler, just like people use. And you may find that that's going to be a little bit easier on your cat's system to actually get that steroid and bronchodilator right where they need it down in their lungs rather than treating their entire body with it. They do make a special adapter for the human inhalers. It's called AeroCat. It's similar to the pediatric adapters that they use for little kids that have asthma that don't know how to take a puff and you have to count breaths and so on. Having her on a tetracycline antibiotic, the minocycline, not a bad idea. We see a number of these cats that will also have mycoplasma as a secondary pneumonia type problem. If your cat isn't getting better, you may want to talk to your veterinarian about doing a bronchial alveolar lavage, where they actually collect some of the material that's down in there to not only look at it for cells and so on, but also to culture it to see if there's another bug that's in there that could potentially be a problem. So, but talk to your vet about using an inhaler. I think that would be probably the best bet for your kitty cat.
Mm-hmm. There we go.
Okay, yeah, because we talked about that thing, but for that that test, they have to like knock them out. And
they
then,
do. They do. Yeah, yeah. It is something that they do have to be under a very short term anesthetic to be able to get this done.
Yeah. Thanks,
so
Jay.
The inhaler would. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call, Jim and Mesa Maney. Thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. I got a question about a yellow lab, 11-year-old yellow lab, and of course they shed. We had her out in a boat for the very first time, and she seemed real nervous and just started flying off of her. The hair was just crazy. I'm wondering if that's a porcupine effect.
It's not like a porcupine where porcupines don't like throw their quills at other animals. They just kind of puff up their quills so that they're there as weapons if somebody does come up and try to bite them. But when we do see dogs that are nervous, in fact, this happens all the time in the veterinary school when I've got pets in the exam room, is they do tend to shed excessively. And there's little tiny muscles attached to each hair that's called the erector pili muscle, and it causes, if you've got a dog that's scared or angry and their hair stands on end, that is what the muscle is used to be able to do that. And so if you've got a dog that's scared, those muscles are probably going to contract and any hair that's about to fall out is going to fall out. And so you're going to have this massive shed when they're scared. If she's that nervous on the boat and she's an adult dog that's never been out there, it may have been, we maybe went a little fast with trying to get her on the boat. I would maybe start with, just being on the dock and near the water and maybe on the boat while it's parked before you start taking her out and you have all that movement and so on to get her more scared and upset. But you can also work on if you want to still continue to take her out on the boat with, using an effective grooming tool for her. Something like the Furminator works really well at trapping all that dead hair and doing that before you get on the boat. So there's going to be less shedding when you get, when you're out there on the water.
Oh, good tip. That's interesting. Every hair has a little muscle attached.
Yeah. It's just a little tiny, little microscopic muscle. And obviously there's more in areas where the hair can stand up, but it's kind of like us. If you've ever had goosebumps and you see the hair on your arm standing up, we've got a very similar type thing going on. So, yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network as we talk about your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. And you can join in by phone if you'd like. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. If you could email us, you could do that at talk@wpr.org. Or you can post on my Facebook page. Just go to The Larry Mueller Show, and you can get on right there. Todd emailed us from Delavan. They have a 3-year-old Maine Coon who's an inside cat. And when it's nice outside, he likes to go out on the front porch with us and play in the grass and chase insects and recently hummingbirds. When it's warm, he will open his mouth and appear to pant and want to stay in the shade or go to the house to lay in the cool hardwood floor. After a few minutes, he's fine, wants back out. Is he overheating, do you think? Also, should I worry about ticks in the lawn?
I would be worried about insects, definitely. If your cat is going outside, should be on some type of flea and tick control and preferably heartworm control as well. We don't see that much heartworm disease in cats in Wisconsin, but it isn't a disease that we can treat. It's a non-treatable disease, and so it's really a tough one for cats to have to deal with if they do contract it. So that would be something to talk to your veterinarian about. When I think of Maine Coons, I think of a giant breed dog, except this is in a cat body. And they get a lot of the same orthopedic diseases and so on that we do see in giant breed dogs. And one of the big issues that we see with Maine Coons that can result in them having exercise intolerance, panting more, and so on, is a heart problem. They do have issues with their heart. And if your cat has not had a good physical done recently, this would be something I would bring up with your veterinarian. They should have a good listen to your cat's heart. If they hear a murmur, then, you know, doing some further workup to make sure that there's nothing serious going on. But that would be one of my first thoughts. It's possible that your cat's just getting overheated and stressed, and we do see cats that will open mouth breathe in certain situations. But I always worry about medical problems because we just don't see cats panting that often. Time to get your cat in and get that looked into.
Sort of a related question here from Steve in Madison. He lives in a second story apartment with an indoor cat, never goes outside except onto the second story balcony. Do I need to worry about fleas, ticks, and other bug bites there?
Probably not. When we've got a pet that's outside, I mean, obviously mosquitoes transmit heartworm, but pretty low risk, especially if you're not having your cat out in the, you know, heavy mosquito time like dawn and dusk type times. But ticks usually are only a few inches off the ground. They're not going to probably go more than a foot, maybe 18 inches off the ground on vegetation. So you're not going to find them up on your second floor apartment. And unless you've got wildlife climbing up and visiting you up on your deck, things like raccoons, possums, and so on, then you really don't have a flea risk either. You probably have more of a flea risk in the communal hallways in your apartment if there are other pets that are living there, such as dogs and other cats that may be, you know, walking on the surface out there. If they have fleas, they may be dropping eggs, and that can be a spot that you may pick them up on your clothing and then bring them into your cat as well. So, again, I would not be looking at your cat as a high risk and probably not do anything.
John in La Crosse, thanks for calling. Hi.
Yeah, thanks. I wonder if you'd kind of advise me. I'm 74 years old. I've had a lot of Airedales. I really like Airedales. So I've had four of them. And I'm thinking about getting another Airedale. Now, I'm in good shape now. I won't be in good shape forever, I'm sure. But what do you think? They're kind of exuberant. They're kind of physical. They don't always like the mind. They have a mind of their own. What do you think about an Airedale?
And this is really important to be thinking about that because, you know, life changes over time. And Airedales are big, strong terriers. And if you really like that kind of personality of a terrier, like the Airedale type spunk and so on, you may want to look at one of the smaller versions. A Lakeland Terrier, an Irish Terrier. There's several are out there, and I'm totally drawing a blank. And please, somebody out there that's a dog breeder or the show's dogs, tell me. There's one that looks like a little miniature Airedale that is like same. Pardon me?
A Welsh Terrier.
Welsh Terrier, okay. But that might be something to, you know, he's a little bit smaller. But even looking at things like maybe a Kerry Blue, they're not going to be quite as tall, but they're not going to be as small as some of these, you know, tinier terriers that I've just mentioned. So my recommendation is go to a dog show, spend some time looking at other breeds of dogs, spend some time talking to the breeders, visiting kennels, do your homework because this is a huge investment. You're going to be, you know, when you adopt a dog, you're looking at, you know, the next 10 to 15 years of having this companionship and, And I've seen 10-year-old Airedales that act like puppies still. So, you know, that's going to be a problem for you as obviously as you get older. Even though you're fit now, you never know. Sorry, maybe you'll be, you know, winning a marathon in your 80s. So.
Yeah, never know.
Well, I was going to ask, what do you think? My understanding is Airedales sort of had a mind of their own, and trainers have a difficult time. You know, they know what they're supposed to do, but they decide they'd rather not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is that a personality trait? I mean, I think I could train the dog, but if it's inborn. Resistance to doing what they're doing.
Yeah, and if you are working with a breeder who, I mean, there are going to be different personalities, and you need to see, like, what are mom and dad like? What's the history of their offspring? Be doing careful selection of where you get your dog. I see some Airedales come into my clinic that are just marvelous, mild-mannered, easygoing, well-trained, you know, sweet, sweet dogs. And then you get others that I call Airedale terrorists that are just, jumping all over the place, totally unruly. But that's true with any dog. It's just that Airedales, with their long legs and they're so muscular, they just have a little more spring in their step than some of the other dogs that we deal with. So, again, do your homework. If you really set on an Airedale, and they are beautiful dogs, but get one from a breeder that is breeding for temperament rather than just looks.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thanks, John, for calling. And Gary in Lime Springs, Iowa, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi. Thank you, Dr. Nair, for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a yellow lab mix. He's getting older. He's about 13 now, but he loves to run. He's active. He's long-legged and slender, but now when he gets up, especially in the morning, he's got a pretty bad limp in the right front leg, and I didn't know if he's getting a little arthritis in that or what. After he's on it for a while, like later in the day, it's not nearly as bad. I didn't know if that's something that should be looked at and if there's some kind of treatment or if there'd be something I could give him just to make it a little bit easier. Less painful for him.
Yeah, you always want to get something like this looked into. I mean, it's the fact that he warms out of it makes nasty things like bone cancers and nerve tumors and so on a much lower on the rule out list. But having them looked at, because sometimes, I mean, it could be a tendon damage, there could be something that may be able to be corrected or locally treated with some physical therapy, they're doing laser therapy and so on with some dogs with joint problems. So there's other modalities that you could look into, but you'd have to find out what's actually causing him to have this issue. But if it does come down to the fact that your dog has, just simple, degenerative joint disease, secondary to, age-related arthritis, the program that we kind of promote at the veterinary school, we call it the WEDS program, WEDDS. And it stands for, the first W stands for weight control. And it doesn't sound like that's an issue for your dog, but, take the advice of your veterinarian. If they say he needs to lose a few pounds, believe them, because most owners underestimate how heavy their dog really is. E stands for exercise, and it sounds like your dog's getting lots of exercise, but you need to sometimes modify the exercise to be things like swimming rather than running on hard surfaces. So it's kind of like water aerobics for older people. You get that exercise, but the buoyancy as well to help support those joints. D stands for diet, and when we're looking at diets, there are some joint diets out there that a couple of the major pet food manufacturers make that are enriched with fatty acids, antioxidants and so on, and extra glucosamine and chondroitin sulfate that, again, may, as a diet, be something that would be suitable to flip your dog over to. Again, talking to your veterinarian to make sure that would be appropriate. D stands for drugs, and that would be pain control drugs. Things like non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, Neurontin is a human drug that we sometimes will add in with those. Tramadol is another one that we'll often use. So having your dog sometimes on a long-term anti-inflammatory may make them feel better. And the last is S, and that stands for supplements. Glucosamine, fatty acids, and so on. And so we go through all of those things, and sometimes we get relief, sometimes we don't, but we want to make sure that your dog has good quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks very much for calling. But an email from Will in Alaska, who has a sweet older Maine Coon cat who has a, he was at the SPCA for over a year before Will adopted him. Great cat, almost human-sounding cough, about three or four times a week. Each episode lasts about a minute. He seems fine afterwards. You mentioned a possible lung infection that sounded fungal. Can you tell us a little more about that and the treatment, please?
What I mentioned was something called mycoplasma, and it's not really a fungus. It's a bacteria, sort of like a bacteria, responds usually to tetracycline antibiotics. And it's just a very common bug that we do see causing chronic infections in the lungs. The fact that the cat's only coughing a couple of times a week makes me think that this is not an infectious thing. I, again, being a big Maine Coon, if they haven't been in to be checked, get that cat in because they are definitely overrepresented with having conditions like cardiomyopathy.
Some great photos again on our Facebook page. Abby sent a couple of her and Elsie. Elsie and Hugo say thank you for the show. Now let's go play.
All right. It looks like we've got a Newfoundland and probably a Bernese Mountain Dog.
Yeah, it looks like it. Oh, my goodness. There's a
beautiful.
Couple of beautiful dogs. And Sarah sent a photo. This is my Great Dane, Moose, stealing my spot in bed every morning. He's a rescue dog who was malnourished and weighed only 90 pounds when we got him 2 years ago. He now weighs 136. We can't get him to gain any more. Do you have any suggestions? He's still very skinny.
Oh, you know, and some of them just are very slender dogs, but making sure they don't have any malabsorption, maldigestion problems. So that would mean getting a little bit of extra workup done by the vet. But sometimes it's just genetics. And I thought it was really interesting, the Mayo study that was published recently on dogs or cats could keep you from getting a good night's sleep. Seeing that dog there, I don't think I would be able to sleep very well either.
Not with old Moose in bed with you.
Right.
Oh, my goodness me. He's a big, big dog. We have lots more. A caller wondered about who lost her Portuguese water dog. She's looking to find another one through a rescue, but hasn't been having much luck. Do you have advice for good rescue programs in 30 seconds?
Boy, you know, I go to Dr. Google for something like this and start looking at the group and visiting and finding out. I know that there's people that are out there that are, you know, taking pets in. They're almost like hoarders that will maybe adopt a pet out. But boy, you know, if it's a rescue group, they're usually going to be backed up by the breed clubs and so on. So contact some breeders. They usually have their finger on the pulse.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk will be with us right up until 12:30. We'll take a quick look at the news and then we will be back. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. You can join in if you have a question or comment for her at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Dr. Sandy, once again, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
We have often have had questions about diet, and grain-free food comes up pretty often.
It does. It's kind of the new craze in the pet food world. And if you go to pet stores, you're going to see this all over the place. Many, many brands. And I know that you feed your cats one of these foods. And it makes sense for cats because they are true carnivores. And but if the grains are cooked and part of the diet, they can be a nutritional component without causing the cat any issues. But here's some of the reasons why I've had people come in and say this is why they want to use it. One, they're afraid of gluten. And I think it's kind of the grain-free diet is following the gluten craze for people. Most people don't even know what gluten is, but the only animal we've ever seen gluten intolerance in is Irish setters, and it's very uncommon. It's a genetic trait in that particular breed, never been identified in any other breeds yet. Mm. So unless you're an Irish setter owner, don't bring up the gluten issue with me. And then food allergies. people think that grains are like the number one thing for food allergies. But when you really look at how food allergies are ranked, wheat is actually third to beef and dairy. And corn comes in eighth behind chicken, eggs and lamb. So, you know, they're it's uncommon, although we do see food allergies. They're not that common. And grains are definitely not part of, not something that we get super worried about. There, they can be, but it's not always there. Many people think that I want to feed my dog a real high-protein food that's carbohydrate-free or low in carbs. And in reality, if you're feeding a kibble, there has to be some form of carbohydrate in there. And it doesn't necessarily mean that the carbohydrate that they put in there, it may be something like potatoes, is going to be nutritionally as good as one of the ones like wheat or corn. And so just because it says sweet potatoes or potato on there, you don't get fooled into thinking that it's better than other things that could be a source of carbohydrates in the diet. And the last thing is I get people thinking that dogs in particular can't digest grains. And when they've started looking at genetically the difference between dogs and wolves, that dogs actually have more amylase, which is the enzyme that you have to use to digest grains. And they're genetically different than wolves in that sense, and that their gut is going to be different in their ability to digest things. And you know that the extra money you're paying for these diets, boy, I mean, you could put that towards some of your veterinary care and have your pet be just do just as well. And one of the nutritionists came out with a really good quote that I just think is so great, that you know, when you're feeding this high protein, these high protein diets, since protein can't be stored, if you're feeding an excessive amount that your pet doesn't need, it just makes for some expensive urine, because they have to pee out all those extra the digestive end products of protein digestion ends up going out through the kidneys and out onto your lawn. So if you want expensive urine, keep feeding some of these diets. Yeah.
Oh, well, with that in mind, let's turn to Nancy in Freeport, Illinois. Hi, Nancy. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have a lab Staffordshire Terrier mix, and he has trouble with his anal glands. I was wondering if you had any suggestions.
Yeah, I mean, this can be a real issue for certain breeds of dogs, and it may be anatomical, the way they're built. If the ducts are kind of tipped a little bit or whatever, they may not drain totally. If the secretion in the glands is thicker than it should be watery and come out when they have a normal bowel movement. But, you know, if you're feeding a really highly digestible diet, your dog's producing very little stool, smaller stools. One of the thoughts is, you know, potentially adding in more roughage, vegetable material, a higher fiber diet, where they may be passing more stool, which may put pressure on those anal glands and allow them to empty more thoroughly. But even with doing that, many people still continue to have problems. And if they're getting infected, if they're really bothering the dog, you know, look into having them surgically removed. It would be something that obviously you don't want to take lightly, because it involves anesthetic and there can be potentially some complications, although they're very uncommon. Then the dog lives without them. And I've had two dogs in my life that I've needed to do this to. And boy, it changed our relationship. Instead of, you know, having that smell around the house and having to express their glands weekly, they became much nicer housemates to be able to live with.
There you go.
Actually, the house is no problem. His stools are formed, but not hard. I just want to ask you, if I added, like, gave him like a cup of old-fashioned oatmeal, you know, the old-fashioned kind you cook a day, along with his dog food, do you think that would help form up his stools?
I would really be worried about you making the diet unbalanced by having that much of a supplement in there. I think that I would rather you go look at how much fiber is in your dog food and go and get a balanced dog food that has the AFCO seal of approval on it, that is just higher in fiber. And that the fiber level is mandatory that they put that on the bag. So you it's going to be really easy to compare fiber in your food to fiber in another food. But just make sure that it's a balanced diet for your dog.
And fiber, how much fiber would you expect to be good in?
Boy, I mean, it really varies across the board. But I mean, some of these really low fiber foods may only have like 5% fiber. Some of the diet foods can have as high as 15%. Okay. So it's usually in that range.
Thanks, Nancy, for calling. I want to give Jake in Winona, Minnesota a chance next. Hi, Jake.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a Pembroke Welsh Corgi, and he has a problem with licking his feet and even nibbling on it to a point. And I've taken him to the vet, and the vet prescribed a spray that's supposed to just taste bad to deter him from doing this behavior, but he just powers right through it most of the time.
Yeah, and when I see dogs that are foot lickers, kind of two things come to mind. By far, the most common reason is that they've got some type of an allergic skin disease with the feet coming in contact with something outside, or even some of the inhaled allergens can affect skin as well. And then once you've got that irritated skin, you can get secondary bacterial infections. So if you were to come in and see me, what I'd be doing is spreading each of the toes, looking underneath at the pad, collecting some of the, I like to call it toe jam, but the stuff that's like in between the pads, and look at under the microscope to see what is living there. Many of the dogs that are foot lickers like this will have chronic yeast infections that can be very itchy and really bothersome and may need to be treated either topically or and often orally, giving some oral antifungals as well. The other reason why I'll see dogs licking their feet is sometimes just it's a compulsive disorder where they just are, you know, they do it when they're stressed. They'll just start licking a spot. It's usually one foot. It may not be all of them. And again, if you start looking for signs of infection, you're not going to find anything in those pets, just usually evidence of like staining and so on from their saliva. But I think it's time to go back to your veterinarian and say, look for a source of infection, because that may be what's causing my dog to have problems.
There you go.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Jake. Lisa in Summit Lake. Hi.
Hi. I have a question. I have a little coon, hound, walker, plot mix. Anyway, we were horseback riding this weekend, and my sister-in-law sprayed her with the flea and tick spray that they use for their horses,
mm-hmm.
for the animals. Could that potentially be harmful for my dog?
I have no idea, because I don't know what's in it. I'd have to know what the ingredients are. I'd have to know the strength. I'd have to know how many pumps of spray you put on your dog, how much your dog weighs. Those are all things that we have to factor in when we're applying insecticides to our pet. I think that if you are looking for a spray to be able to use on your pet intermittently when you're out in the field, Frontline, that most people think of that as just the spot on that you use once a month, is still available in a spray form that you can use on your dog. It makes them a little crunchy. It's kind of dries and makes their hair a little like they've had some kind of moussey type stuff in it, but it softens up pretty quickly. But that gives you really fast flea and tick coverage compared to putting the spot on that needs to be able to spread through the hair coat. So, you know, before you start grabbing horse spray, make sure that it is a product that is approved for dogs. That's probably one of the number one issues that we see when it comes to household poisons and so on, is people, you know, using insecticides improperly.
And there's an actual, you have a top 10 list of poisons.
I do. And, you know, the reason why I looked into this, I thought this was interesting when I saw this pop up, is the other day I take a couple of blood pressure medications, and I opened up my little pill thing and it spilled, and I had pills all over the kitchen floor, and I have a new puppy now. And so you can imagine my horror that this dog is running in there, and I'm madly trying to pick up pills. And thinking, oh, you know, but that is the number one thing, is getting into human medication. Number two is insecticides. So using something like a product that you would use on another species, or a dog product on a cat that isn't approved, is definitely number two. Over-the-counter medications, people grabbing their own ibuprofen or Tylenol, something like that, that accounts for 14.7% of the cases that are reported to the Animal Poison Control Center. Other things like in the household, expandable glues and paint. I thought that was really You know, I've never even thought of that. But leaving your Gorilla Glue or something like that out, there are now more and more of these products around. And if the dog bites into it and gets it in their body, you can imagine what that would do in their stomach. So that actually accounted for 9.3%, almost 10% of the toxicities we see. Most people think that human food is going to be right up there, but that's actually number five. Okay. So it's not that common, but that's onions, garlic, grapes, xylitol, and so on. It's going to be less common than some of these other things. Then it comes down to us as veterinarians, the meds that we prescribe for your dog. You know, there's a reason why we, you know, tell you keep it out of reach. I can't tell you how many pets I've known that have we've sent home something that can be toxic if they take too much of it. But because it's beef flavored, they, you know, are able to get at it and they'll eat the whole bottle of something like Rimadyl. And then we get into chocolate and rat baits and so on, household plants, and then lawn and garden products are down pretty low. But remember, cocoa bean mulch, toxic for dogs. It smells nice, looks nice, but don't use it in your yard if you have a dog.
We have Ann and Thorpe with a question for you, Sandy. Hi, Ann. Thank you for calling.
Well, hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have a rough coat collie that just was a year old last week. And she's different than any other collie I've ever had or known. She's aggressive, she's jealous, and she's got a one-track mind like I've never seen on a dog. And I was kind of wondering, is that something that I've had nice collies before, or is this something that's different in collies? And is there hope to have that trained out of her?
Well, you know, part of this would be looking at her family tree, going back and talking to the breeder. Hopefully you visited mom and dad, and a reputable breeder is going to be selecting for dogs that aren't just pretty, but are going to have, you know, good personalities as well. And this may just be a fluke. It could just be the oddball dog in the group that is going to be at the far end of the bell curve. It may be related to early training or lack of training and exposure. So I'm not sure how much you put into with puppy training classes and so on to get her out and about and around other people and dogs. But this would be something that aggression is one of those things where it can really, I mean, there's so many reasons why dogs can be aggressive. I mean, you've given us a lot of your ideas, but it may be that, you know, someone who is actually trained to look at dog body language and applied animal behaviorist is going to be able to see that your dog might be reacting this way because it's fearful. And we're just making it worse by the way we keep trying to maybe control the dog. So before you throw your dog into a training class, you really need to get an assessment, get a diagnosis, get some help from a trained professional. This would not be just a dog trainer or a dog training class, but an applied animal behaviorist. Your vet could probably help you find somebody locally in your area.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Good luck, Ann. Thank you for calling. And we have Irene in Wauwatosa next. Hi, Irene.
Hi, thank you. I have a 9-year-old Shih Tzu who more than a year ago had swallowed a cat toy. And then we had some blood tests done. I mean, the cat toy turned out to be no problem. But the blood test showed very high alkaline phosphatase and other liver enzymes. And so then she was put on a Hill's Science low-fat diet and retested, and it was still high. And now she's on the Hill's hepatic liver diet.
Okay.
But the vet, we cannot figure out why she's perfectly happy, healthy.
Yeah. Yeah, we see this all the time. And it's one of these ones where I will often like be pulling my hair out. What is wrong with this animal? But I'm glad that your dog had some blood work done. That's perfect. We like to do that as dogs get older to start monitoring things. Alkaline phosphatase is a liver enzyme that is related to the bile system in the liver. And so it's not the cells of the liver, but it's the biliary system of the liver. And sometimes we can see that be elevated with certain liver issues, but we can also see it with other things outside the liver. Adrenal gland problems, a condition called Cushing's disease, will often cause a dog to have elevated alkaline phosphatase. Sometimes medications, things like phenobarbital, steroids, and so on that may be given not only orally, but steroids topically can cause alkaline phosphatase to go up. Once, you know, if I get a case like this in, the dog's feeling good. Usually I like to do a test to rule out Cushing's disease. It's a simple urine test called a urine cortisol creatinine ratio. We get that submitted. If it comes back normal, I'll kind of lay out what we can do, especially if the dog is feeling good. With, you know, I'll say, if you want, we can jump in and do an ultrasound so we can look at the gallbladder, you know, look at the liver, get a little, you know, biopsy if we need to, if we see something abnormal. If that comes back absolutely normal, then doing what your veterinarian's doing, a liver diet, maybe a liver supplement. We use something called Denimarin, which is a milk thistle supplement. It just happens to be one that's available for dog use. Sometimes helps these dogs. But I'm a big believer that I treat patients, I don't treat pieces of paper with lab data on it. And once I get to that point where we've really found no reason for this, we can't pursue it, she's going to be one of those many dogs that's walking around with an elevated level. And I have a, right now I'm balancing about half a dozen of those patients in my practice, and I wish I could tell you what was wrong with them.
Wow. There you go, Irene. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to give Ellen in Elton Grove a chance to join in the discussion here. So let's go to her. Hi, Ellen. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. Please bear with me. I'll probably break down halfway through here. I have a little mini long-haired Doxy. She's on her way to 17. She's in kidney failure, though you'd never know it looking at her. You know, she's still spry and looks good. You know, my problem now is getting her to eat. She's on enalapril, and I just got through with the first 5 days of Serenia for her, and her appetite is sort of there, but then of course she turns her nose up, and you know, I've done, you know, one day it was grilled cheese sandwich, you know, and then the next day she wouldn't eat it because she felt like garbage afterwards. For 2 days it's been tuna. She'll eat my bird's veggies, and then she won't. And then, you know, so I know I'm at the end. She seems pretty perky and all, but how long can I go on with her like this? Or, I mean, what generally, you know, what generally happens? I mean, is there sort of like, oh, it'll go on for 2 months? Or, I mean, I wish it would go on forever. But.
Yeah, you know, it's unfortunate. Dogs don't live with kidney failure as well as cats do. But things that you could potentially do if, you know, sometimes gastroprotective agents like Pepcid and so on would be something, because some dogs that have those elevated kidney values will start to get ulcers in their stomach, and that can make them feel really nauseated and uncomfortable. And so working with your veterinarian to come up with some drugs to help make the stomach feel better. The Serenia that you used as an anti-nausea drug works in the brain. It's not going to work directly on the stomach and make the stomach feel better itself. So it's not a bad drug to use. We use it a lot for vomiting dogs, but it's probably, you know, as soon as they're off of it, going to be running into troubles with their stomach still acting up. If your dog needs to be on fluids, sometimes subcutaneous fluids may buy you some time as well if they tolerate
that.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, again, cats have such expandable skin compared to dogs. It's a little bit different story. There's a really nice website that, even though it's made for veterinarians, you sound like you're pretty well versed in dealing with kidney disease, but it's called the IRIS Kidney website. It stands for International Renal Interest Society. And they have a number of like flow charts and things like that that you can be looking at. Here's my dog's lab data, what we're doing, and kind of see like the different treatment protocols and things that you can use to be able to buy your dog some time and help them. But I think it's wise for you to be looking at, you know, on a day by day basis, how happy your dog really is. And they can put in, I mean, there are some patients that will get them some time by putting in a stomach tube so that they can continue to eat without them doing it. But again, is that going to be affecting your quality of life and hers as well? It's, you know, the best gift you can give her is a pain-free end, and ending with kidney disease where they're so sick, they've got sores in their mouth and so on, is they're just miserable. And she's close to that. I would think she's getting to that point, but it's, you know, how much longer you have, I wish I could predict. It's, you know, it may be days, it could be weeks. So
So I want to just watch for
just her attitude.
Right.
I mean, I think I'm doing just about everything I can. Now, could I do Pepcid along with the Serenia?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I have Pepcid. I'll just start that up, too.
Okay. And, all right.
But, yeah, it's fairly painful, though, when it gets to
It is.
Point,
they're very sick and nauseated and uncomfortable. So, yep.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. Good luck.
And you. I hope
enjoy every day. Enjoy every day you have with her.
Yeah.
I do.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Here we are at the end of another
show. I know. Crying, both of us.
Every show ends with, it seems lately.
Either that or diarrhea, you know.
Oh, my goodness. I'm going to invite people to take a look at our Facebook page because there's some just absolutely gorgeous pictures up there of some dogs that we haven't had a chance to talk about. And Sandy, thank you so much. You'll be back actually on July 8th next time around.
There we go. Yeah.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest, I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you for listening. Please stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.